What happened? Did I faint? What did he leave us? Did he leave us any toys?
I was robbed! I spent the whole night waiting for the great pumpkin, but I could have been out for tricks or treats! Halloween is over and I missed it! You blockhead! You kept me up all night waiting for the great pumpkin, and all that came was a beagle! I didn't get a chance to go out for tricks or treats! And it was all your fault! Also!
Hello and welcome to the fourth Living Room Times podcast. We figured we'd open up with a Halloween-related clip since this is going to be our last show before Halloween.
And in case you don't know, that is from Charlie Brown's The Great Pumpkin, and that's when Sally discovers that the Great Pumpkin is actually Snoopy rising up in the pumpkin patch, and Linus passes out, and then he wakes up and he's like, oh, is it the Great Pumpkin? What did he leave us? And she's like, oh, whatever. And yeah. But yeah. It was far more eloquent than that.
Yeah, it was what you just heard. but admittedly, you couldn't see it, so I understand the need for the summary. Becky's giving me a withering look right now. We're coming to you on, it's actually Saturday evening as we're recording this because of scheduling issues on Sunday. And I've got the ongoing college football games open on the screen. So, and if you hear me cry out or say panic or chaos or anything like that, you'll know why. Right, the big game right now is Missouri's up 17-14 over Oklahoma, which is number one in the BCS. And if Missouri wins the game, not only would it produce mass chaos and help Boise State and those teams, but it would also mean that Oregon would most likely come in to USC next Saturday as number one, not only in the AP poll but in the BCS. So that would be nice. And
yes, so nice.
Yeah. And my other comment is that right now Mississippi State, which just got ranked this week because they're 5-2 and they're 2-2 in the SEC. And God knows that anyone who's 500 in the SEC was clearly like a top 10 team. They're number 24 in the country, and they're 2 points ahead on UAB, which is a terrible team from Conference USA that also almost beat Tennessee this year and lost them in overtime. So I figured that we should probably award the UAB the SEC title. Anyway, so.
Thrilling.
What do you mean? Me talking about college football scores? They're going to be totally outdated by the time anyone hears this. Is not completely exciting. I can't imagine why you would think that.
Yes, right. I can also not imagine that.
All right.
What was your favorite part?
So this is the part of the show we talk about our favorite part of the week. And do you want to go first?
Ladies first, of course. So we actually had kind of a crummy week in our household. We went through the stomach flu. So Loyette woke up on Monday night after she threw up, but she didn't actually come to get us. She just sort of stood in the door and didn't really understand what had happened. But she told us, you know, my bed is yucky, so she's all covered in puke.
Well, I was when I went upstairs and she's standing there and she goes, "Daddy, something came out and it's sticky," and she was happy. She didn't have the words for it. Yeah, not that she was like 6 months old. She didn't have the words for it, but she wasn't really traumatized by it so much as just she was kind of thought it was interesting and was trying to explain.
Traumatized by it. Yeah, well, deeply traumatized. Yeah. I was like, "Daddy, you are dealing with this barf. I'm off duty." It is like 11 o'clock at night, but yeah, so we had kind of a tough week. Then I got the stomach flu, but luckily it skipped Brendan and so hopefully that'll still be the case. But anyways, before she got the flu, Loyette went to a pumpkin patch with her preschool, and she picked out the littlest, tiniest pumpkin you have ever seen and brought it to me when I came to pick her up, and she held it aloft very proudly and said, "Mommy, look at my little tiny baby pumpkin," which is something that her voice will go up like an octave and a half when she's talking about something small. So it's hard to express how adorable that is to have your little kid being like, "It's a little tiny baby pumpkin." But yeah, that was definitely my favorite part of the week.
Well, I don't have anything that cute to relate, but I'll say my favorite part of the week was actually what I should have given at the last podcast as the thing I was looking forward to, and I realized it about 15 minutes after we recorded it, which was that on Monday night, I went to a rally to see Bill Clinton and Michael Bennett. Bennett's the Democratic Senate candidate who's here in Colorado, who's locked in a tight race with Ken Buck and is probably going to lose. Ken Buck is a Tea Partier, pretty right-wing, but you know, it's a good cycle for him. And he's just done barely on this close enough on this side of sanity that he's able to pull it off on, like, Dan Mays, the Republican governor candidate, who's just completely incompetent and nuts. But anyway, so Bennett was having a get out the vote or an early vote rally, because it was the first day of early voting. So it was an early vote rally with Bill Clinton. And it was up at a school in northeast Denver. So I went. It was like 8:15 at night. So I was able to go after the girls were asleep. And it was kind of fun. I was posting all these snarky tweets about Democratic enthusiasm. I said, you know, why, there are literally hundreds of mildly enthusiastic Democrats here. GOP panic. But in reality, it was a pretty enthusiastic crowd, particularly enthusiastic for Bill Clinton. I mean, that's why everyone was there, was to see Bill.
And I have to say that having seen Bill Clinton speak before, the man is a great speaker. Like, if you have an opportunity to go and just listen to him talk, he really knows how to work a crowd. It's actually quite an art form, and he's good at it. So, I mean, regardless of your politics, I think it's excellent to expose yourself to people who are masters of their craft.
Don't talk about exposing yourself to Bill Clinton. That can be dangerous.
Touche.
No, but he's good. He is good. And I was actually going to say that.
And remarkably, so much better than Bennett that it's embarrassing to have him on stage at the same time.
Oh, it was funny. You know, they had Bennett go first and then Clinton. And ideally, I would assume you probably want to have the candidate be the keynote featured speaker, have the guest introduce him. But that was a very wise move on the part of the organizers of this event. Because not only did Clinton go on for an hour, so it would have been kind of weird to be waiting for Bennett. But also, he just would have been completely outclassed if he had to follow Clinton. Having him up there to introduce Clinton worked much better. I really enjoyed listening to Clinton speak. And what I found about his speech was that it was more intelligent than your typical political stump speech, where I feel like normally when I listen to a politician talk, it's kind of like, to go back to the Charlie Brown theme for a moment, it's kind of like wah, 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 where they're just...
It's sound bites.
Yeah, it's just sound bites of things that I've already... It's arguments that I've already heard rehashed and debunked, whoever it's from. The simplistic soundbite versions of the arguments are always wrong. And I just... It's just sort of... It's more of... I go to it for the theater. I don't listen to a political speech expecting to be educated, let alone inspired.
Oh, and speaking of theater, Sarah Palin, excellent on the theater.
Yes. But anyway, what I found with Clinton's speech was that he had his canned lines, and he had some you know, plenty of talking points, no question. But when he really got going talking about the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, and sort of defending why the Democrats' record is better than the Republicans, and they've done better on the deficit over the years, and of course a lot of what he's doing is defending his own record, and there's nothing that Bill Clinton loves more than to defend his own record, because he's a huge egotist.
Well, and to talk about himself.
Yeah. Talk about his policies and why his policies are awesome and everyone else's suck. But basically, he made a very intelligent and impassioned defense of the Democrats and the Democratic agenda, and an attack on the Republican agenda, which I'm sure plenty of listeners of this podcast would disagree with, and I'm sure there are factual holes in it. But it wasn't as obviously fraudulent and talking point filled and just sort of down to the lowest common denominator that you hear even from Obama, and I like Obama. I'm a fan of Obama, but you know there are a lot of straw men in Obama speeches. You know, it's always like the Republicans say that we have to make a choice between growing our economy and killing kittens, and to that I say no. You know, that's like all. That's his. It's what he always does. He always sets up these false choices that no one is proposing. Clinton didn't do that so much. He came out and he said, here's what the Republicans are saying about us. And what he said is basically what they're saying about the Democrats. It was a pretty faithful rendering of what the Republicans say. And then he would say, and here's the 10 reasons why it's wrong. And it really was 10 reasons. This is why he went on for an hour. But it was really interesting. And I enjoyed it. It actually kind of made me feel like, yeah, I want to go vote for the Democrats. You know, like it inspired like a little bit of partisan feeling in me that I don't usually get from a political speech, because usually political speeches are just so dumb. But it was actually pretty good. So I enjoyed that a lot. So that was my favorite part of the week.
Yay.
So our topics for this week are both NPR related. And the obvious, I think we'll save the obvious one for last.
Our Juan Williams.
Yeah, but the first thing I wanted to talk about was, originates from an NPR story, and that's the only way in which it's NPR related. There's an NPR story that was on All Things Considered, Morning Edition.
And Brendan will link to it from his website.
I'll link to it. And it's it was on Monday on Morning Edition, and it was a story about I think the title of the article, the one with the story is, What's a Journalism Degree Worth Anyway? Or something like that.
It was about the USC Annenberg Journalism School and student debates about whether or not it was actually worth the cost.
Right, or I wouldn't say it was about Annenberg, but Annenberg was the sort of the example that they used because they're lazy and they have a reporter in LA, so they just go down to the local journalism school. You know, it's not like they flew out to Columbia, Missouri or something. But Annenberg's a good school. And so they went and they talked to the various students and the dean, the new dean there and stuff, and got all these quotes about journalism school. And basically the premise of the article was, journalism is an industry is dying. So why would anyone go into journalism and pay to go into journalism? And to get a journalism degree when you actually don't even need a degree. And some journalists say that it's better to get a degree in something else, to have broader experience. And it was pretty interesting, and it had all these quotes from people who were saying, we're going to, yes, the industry seems to be dying, but there'll always be journalism in some form, and we're going to be the ones who reinvent the profession, and we're, all this sort of idealistic mumbo jumbo, and that's fine, and if you catch me in the right mood, I can be an idealist about journalism. What I found frustrating about the article and the NPR piece that went with it on the radio was that it never addressed what to me is the issue here that cries out for attention, which is not this sort of generic question of, is a degree worth it in some abstract sense?
Philosophical, idealistic way, yes.
Right. But, okay, so you're going to graduate with a journalism degree, and then you're going to and you're going to USC, so unless you have, I went to the USC Journalism School on full scholarship. I was lucky. I didn't have to worry about this. But if you're going there even on a half scholarship and you've got to fund the rest of it through loans, that's hugely expensive.
Yeah, you're talking $80,000 to $100,000 in loans
at least. For a half, if you have a half scholarship?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, because it's like $50,000 a year if you're paying for everything. So if it's, $25,000 a year if you've got a half paid for it, and you probably don't have half a housing paid for it, But yeah, so it's certainly going to be probably six-figure debt. And what do you have to show for it? Okay, a USC journalism degree. Good for you. I like my USC journalism degree. But journalism isn't a high-paying profession even in good times, even in good economic times and even in good times for the industry.
Yeah, unless you're a superstar journalism who's writing best-selling books.
Or who's like, network anchor or something like that. Like a superstar in broadcast journalism can make a lot of money. But you have to be a superstar. Or you have to, but you do something else, like authoring, which isn't really, I guess it can be journalism, but unless you're Bob Woodward, it's like, you're not going to be making, six figures, certainly. You're not even going to be making high five figures. And so you're going to come out of school with this huge debt, and the question to me...
Limited in earning potential.
Right. Is it worth it in the abstract? I don't know, maybe, but is it worth getting into that kind of debt? And this speaks to a broader concern that I have and have had, growing in my mind in recent years, in the way that we are increasingly saddling the young generation with these huge, huge debts when they get out of school. You graduate from college at 21 and
22.
Or 22, and you have, $100,000 in debt, $150,000 in debt,
$30,000, even $30,000 or $50,000.
It's one thing to say, I have a couple thousand dollars in debt. Okay, you can pay that. You can pay off, $5,000 debt. And if you have a college education and you can't pay off a $5,000 debt in a year or two, you're kind of dumb. You're clearly not very resourceful or not very committed to paying off your debt. But if you come out of college with a debt of, $50,000, $75,000, $100,000, $200,000, that is something that is going to affect the choices that you can make in your life for a long time,
years,
potentially, a decade or two. And one of the things that drives me crazy, and it drove me crazy about this story, is that so often I feel like journalists tackle issues where a central portion of the issue is that very concern, and they don't get at it. I heard a story at NPR a few months ago that was talking about,
college graduates, 20
somethings. Yeah, are staying at home or, moving back in with their parents and the adult adolescent cultural phenomenon. And it's always phrased in terms of a cultural phenomenon. It's like that. What does this say about the social and cultural mores of this generation? And I'm like, it says they have debt and they can't afford.
The implication of these articles is always that somehow our generation is lazy,
right,
or we're just sitting around scratching our balls,
or
playing the Wii, or we have these overindulgent parents,
right,
who are just bolstering us up.
Right, the baby boomers who are just, overly wishy-washy and all this stuff. And it's just, But, I mean, some of the things may or may not be true. I mean, I'm not saying there's only one issue here. But you cannot pretend that you are addressing these questions unless you look at the debt issue. Because, you know, a generation or two ago, people weren't graduating from college with, you know, multiple years of salary worth of debt to pay off. And so, you know, they could very quickly, you know, get out on their own, get an apartment, and then within a few years, get a car, get a house, start a family. When you look at the current, again, you know, the social trend of people in our generation or a couple years older than us who, you know, waited to start their families until they were in their 30s, which is now the norm. We're the weird ones who had kids, you know, in our mid-20s. That's very unusual among our peers. And you look at, why is that? Is it because of some great social upheaval? I don't know all the reasons for it, but I think a reason for it is this very issue that if you're coming out of college and you've got all this debt, you can't afford to start a family right away. Generally speaking, that's really tough. And so people wait, and it has all sorts of consequences. So anyway, I thought that the NPR piece, you know, raised some interesting questions about journalism, and those are in of themselves worth discussing. But I think that the broader concern that I have is, what are we doing as a society, and what are we going to do about what Glenn Reynolds likes to call the higher education bubble? And I have less use for Glenn Reynolds these days than I used to, frankly, but I think on this one he's hit it spot on. Not that it's that hard to hit, but I really think that he's right to focus on it, that you know, the higher education bubble is a real problem, and it is a bubble, I think, because when we were doing some financial planning not too long ago, and we were looking at how much money we would have to save
if
both of our girls were to go to USC.
USC, just, and the rate of tuition increases holds as it has for the past 5 or 10 years, we would have to be saving almost $4,000 a month now. And I mean, that's absolutely obscene.
You know, when we did that analysis, my reaction was kind of like, yeah, but that's not, there's no way that can be true. I cannot believe that in 16 years, the cost of higher education will be what it would be. And I forget what the raw number is, but, you know, $400,000 or five, whatever it's going to have to be for that to be the case. I just don't think that's possible. I don't think that is a sustainable trend, which is pretty much the definition of a bubble. I don't know how it's going to end, because the reality is, if anything, right now, you know, public school tuition is going up because of the budget crunch all over the place, and all the states cut their budgets. They have to cut money from support for tuition, and so kids are paying more. And of course, you know, I suppose that a conservative would chime in and say that one of the reasons why this is happening is because that as you increase government aid, you make loans more freely available, and also you increase grants and scholarships and all this kind of stuff, the supply and demand is such that the price goes up. And I guess that's true. I don't understand all the economics of it. But the Democratic solution tends to be just throw more money at the problem, and actually arguably throwing money at it is part of the problem. So I don't know how this gets solved. I don't know who solves it. But I know that, you know, it can't be the case that, you know, in 18 years, you know, education is going to continue to rise at whatever ridiculous multiple of inflation that it is. I mean, obviously, the price is going to go up because of just overall inflation, but it can't keep going up like this. And I don't know what
those are famous last words, by the way.
Well, yeah, I know. But I mean, you know, as a society, what are we doing? You know, we're throwing all this money at old people. Who are, you know, giving prescription drugs to seniors and you know, having everybody freak out if you ever suggest that perhaps we could have, like, I don't know, a cut in Medicare. You know, God forbid that, you know, all the...
God forbid that Granny can't have her 15 medications, half of which interact with one another in a negative way.
Right. You know, but I mean, but meanwhile, you know, we're potentially going into a phase where, as the one thing I think the Tea Party is right about, you know, we're going to see tax increases.
And we're bankrupting our kids.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and we're going to see tax increases, and that those are going to hit, you know, the same people that are coming out of college with these huge debts. They're also going to have more taxes.
Yeah.
And what are they funding? Are they funding, you know, the world's best education system for the next generation, or are they funding, you know, a transfer payment to old people that they can't afford to make because they have $250,000 in debt by the time we're talking?
And frankly,
you know,
that they can't afford to make because we're already paying for the profligate spending that those old people did while they were running the country.
Exactly. So, in
anyways, to cut
in conclusion, I'm going to go buy a Gadsden flag now.
Yeah, it's to cut Brennan off so that I can have, you know, I don't know, 2 minutes to comment on this topic as someone who went to college for a liberal arts education, which I have now come to realize is fairly useless. And I hate to say that because I have a lot of friends and family who are very vested in the liberal arts. But if you are a college student and you're listening to this, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Like, get a degree in something that's useful. And I say this as my original plan was with my degree was to go to law school. So, and in that sense, history and poli sci was a great undergrad, but it doesn't exactly lend itself toward toward a lot of employment afterward, especially if you end up going to graduate school in a liberal arts area and then aren't employable afterward. I encourage you to have a path or a plan, because just having a college degree is not enough.
When we were talking about this on the blog, you know, I said, I hate to sound like a cynic, but let's follow up with these optimistic J students in 5 years when they're crushed by debt. And I said, you know, I mean, really, I accumulated that sort of debt from law school, which gets you a professional degree in a high earning field. And even then, it's a huge financial hurdle. And I think one point to consider with this is that we're talking about people who are 18 and 19, 20 years old, making these decisions about, you know, what school they're going to go to, even 17, you know, years old, making these decisions about what school they're going to go to, and then what, you know, what they're going to major in. And, you know, just speaking for myself, thinking back to what, 10 years ago or 12 years ago, you know, when I was making those sorts of decisions, I didn't know the first thing about money, debt, you know, what it means. When you are that age, when you, you know, are say 18 years old, I think that $10,000, $100,000, and $500,000 all sound basically the same. They all just sound like more money than you've ever thought about.
I don't agree with that at all. I think that an 18-year-old has a great concept that $10,000 and $100,000 are a whole world apart.
Maybe not 10 versus 100, but, you know, when you're looking at, you know that you're going to come out of school with a big, big chunk of debt, you know, and it's a difference between, say, $60,000 and $120,000, depending on where you go or whatever. I think that the real-world consequences of that difference are not necessarily apparent.
Even between 60 and 90, I think, yeah, you're probably right on that count. Because at that point, you're just like, wow, that's a whole lot of money.
Right, exactly.
I think that the average 18-year-old looking at college says, well, that doesn't matter if I take out $100,000 in loan because I'll be able to pay it off. And I don't think that they understand, like, if I'm making $35,000 a year and I have other expenses, that I can't just, like, chunk 5 or 10 grand at it a year. And even if you do, that's 10 years. Like, I don't think that people think about the repayment aspects of this.
Right.
All that much. I think that 18-year-olds are infected by optimism that, like, joblessness after graduation won't happen to them. That as soon as they graduate with this awesome college degree from whatever high power school they went to, they will immediately find employment, and that they'll find a good job, and that they'll be on the path to success, and that they will be one of those people who earn six figures by age 30, and so their debt won't matter because they'll be on this path. Like, nobody thinks, I'm going to graduate from school with 80 grand in debt and I'm going to be making $34,000 as a public school teacher. And my salary, maybe 30 years down the road, might be 65 grand.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know what the solution to that is, because I certainly don't want the message to be like, young people, don't follow your dreams. but at the same time, you know, if your dream is to go into a field that isn't going to make a lot of money, maybe you should think about, is there a public school in my state that I can go to that, you know, get that degree in? Because it's, you know, to talk about financing a private education, or, you know, or maybe go down a rung and get a scholarship. You know, if you're looking at an Ivy League and you can go to, you know, the next level down, you know, top 50 and get a scholarship, because otherwise you could have gone to an Ivy League school, maybe that's worth considering. You know, but something, because you know, if
my dad did that with med school. He got into Harvard med school but didn't go because he couldn't really afford it. And he went to the local state school and had a fantastically successful career as a doctor. You don't want to start your life in debt. This is just stupid. Like, you are saying, hello, future, I'm going to start with a 50,000-pound weight tied to my foot, and I'm going to keep throwing dollars at it to try to get it to go away, but I am still trying to run a race here, and I've got $50,000 tied to me. It's a terrible place to have to be to try to strike out and to be burdened by that kind of debt. It takes away your ability to have the prosperity that you think you deserve after you've worked so hard in college.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot more to say about this topic. I've forgotten about 5 different things that I wanted to say. So we might revisit it in some future podcast and maybe have a guest or something. I don't know. But anyway, for now, I think we're going to move on to NPR topic number two, which I guess you can sort of introduce if you'd like.
All right. Well, of course, you've probably heard about this. NPR reporter Juan Williams was trying to be puppet to two masters and got himself in trouble because he's a reporter for NPR, and as a political analyst, he is not allowed to sort of spout incendiary opinions in any context where they're recorded as media. However, he is also a commentator for Fox News, where he is paid to spout incendiary comment.
That's part of the job description.
So, needless to say, he got in trouble for saying something along the lines of, "Hey, bud, you know, when I get on an airplane and I see someone in traditional Muslim garb, I get a little nervous." And then later in Bill O'Reilly's show, he argued that, you know, you can't really brush all Muslims with the same paintbrush, and we shouldn't be discriminating against an entire group, but that commentary about the airplane got him fired. Frankly, I kind of agree with Juan Williams. And I know that's not right, and I should like smack myself, and the liberal police should like come to my door and take me away.
You get fired from the Living Room Times podcast.
I know. But I mean, I gotta say, I do get nervous. Basically, when I see anybody in any kind of theatrical costume, which, frankly, I know that's terrible, but I consider, like, full Muslim garb fairly theatrical, or if I see someone in, like, Orthodox Jewish garb, or, you know, if someone would come in a Halloween costume in the same way, I think it's kind of silly, and it betrays an inner kind of extremism or orthodoxy that makes me nervous, because I'm not an Orthodox person in any sense, and so... So I don't disagree with Juan Williams on this.
If you're walking down the street in Boulder and you see someone in full hippie garb, does it make you nervous?
No, actually, though, I wonder if they smell. I work in Boulder a lot, and I do see a lot of hippies, and I confess that every once in a while, if they walk by my table, I'm like, what is the hippie smell? Because some hippies do have the distinct marijuana smell. Other have like the flowery, you know, aromatherapy smells going on. So you never know what you're going to get with the hippies.
Yeah.
But anyways,
what does marijuana smell like when mixed with BO?
the lovely scent of Boulder. Anyways, so Juan Williams was fired for this rather abruptly and indelicately by the head honchos at NPR, which caused a massive conservative outcry, whereby Jim DeMint, who is the senator from...
South Carolina.
South Carolina, one of those stupid states. basically... introduced a bill to defund NPR, which I think is a terrible idea. But I think in the initial controversy, I got to side with Williams here, although I don't think he's doing too bad for himself because he just got like a $2 million contract with Fox.
$3 million anyway.
Yeah, I know, which is way more than he'd make at NPR. So maybe he's moving up in the world and we should just let bygones be bygones and say, hey, happy trails, Juan. You know, good job. You're a black Hispanic man with a job. Rock on. I mean, but you know, I don't think they should have fired him. I think that if they wanted to sever his contract because of his relationship with Fox, they needed to let him go when his contract was done. I think that somebody in management should probably get axed at NPR for letting that happen.
Yeah. Oh, Missouri took the lead. I think that it was a huge just sort of blunder and unforced error on NPR's part. That really diminishes their credibility when I think that NPR is one of the best journalistic outlets in this country. I think it's the best broadcast journalism outlet because certainly all the cable news is crap. And I don't think...
And I include MSNBC, Fox, and CNN all together in a nice little box of crap.
Yes.
This is not ideologically driven. It's not like we're sitting here like, oh, only Fox News sucks, but Rachel Maddow is God. No.
Yeah. They all suck. And I like to describe Fox and MSNBC as sort of being yin and yang. You know, they're sort of,
they're yin and yang and CNN is boring.
Yeah, you know, CNN tries to be neutral or whatever. I think CNN has the sort of mild liberal bias that you see in a lot of places. But mostly it's just sort of a stupidity bias. They're just, you know, it's just a lot of sensationalistic dumb stuff. And then Fox and MSNBC are both blatantly partisan, ideological, and also dumb and sensationalistic and retarded. So NPR has, I think, that same sort of seeping, creeping liberal bias that you find in a lot of mainstream news organizations.
In terms of, like, their story selection right. in particular.
Right, and occasionally the actual story reporting, though for the most part, I think the reporting is really solid, and it's mostly the story selection where the bias comes across. I think they're less biased, for instance, than the New York Times. I think they're less biased than the Washington Post in terms of the product. Now, the political views of the reporters, I don't know, and I don't care as long as it doesn't come across. I think in general they do a really solid job, really good quality journalism on a lot of topics, including complex topics like healthcare, where you know both parties just have these talking points that they stick to, and there's no you know nothing beyond that. But you listen to NPR's reporting and you realize, oh, everybody's wrong and we're all screwed. You know that. And I
actually, to give a good example of this, on Colorado Matters, our local NPR affiliate, they had interviews with Ken Buck and Michael Bennett, and the interview with Michael Bennett was not a softball interview. You know, he talked a lot about how he wants to reduce the debt, and they, you know, pressed him a bit on like, well, then why did you vote for the stimulus if you want to reduce the debt? And he had to, you know, answer that kind of those kind of questions. And I like that. I like to hear his voice and how he answers, and does he get nervous when he's pushed and prodded? And this NPR is really the only outlet for that. I mean, you don't get to hear that on your network news stations.
Meet the Press, perhaps, but.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's especially if you're talking about locally, I mean, yeah, you're never going to get a local TV station to do a hard-hitting interview with any politician. They're too busy reporting on, like, the latest murder or crime or fire or...
High-speed car chase,
whatever, yeah. So anyway, you know, it's frustrating to me that NPR has, you know, happens to be the news organization at the center of this storm, because to me, they really, in the broad sense, don't deserve it. Because I think they're really quality. And I think, frankly, that anybody who says, oh, NPR is like the liberal Fox News should just, like, lose their license to watch TV or have an opinion about anything, because that's idiotic. Like, MSNBC is the liberal Fox News. If you can't tell the difference, like, objectively between Fox News and NPR...
Well, these are people who never listen to NPR, but they'll pick up, like, one or two broadcast clips of something that happens on NPR.
That they see on, like, some conservative website that's saying, oh, isn't this outrageous? Right. Yeah.
Like that the one Nina Totenberg saying that, like, Jesse Helms' grandchildren should get AIDS or something.
Which was something that she said, I mean, that's awful. But she said that, like, 10 years ago in like, a speech. It wasn't like she said that in an NPR broadcast, and then, you know, Carl Castle was like, way to go, you know, like that. So, yeah, that was she shouldn't have said that. And maybe she should have been fired for saying that. I don't really know or care about that. But yeah, I mean, but that's not representative of what's on NPR. Anyway, so I find the whole thing very frustrating on several levels. I'm frustrated with NPR for what they did, for handling it so poorly. You know, because then they had, after they fired him, then they're being interviewed about it, and they're like, president or some official is like, you know, what he thinks about, you know, going on planes and seeing Muslims should be between him and his psychiatrist.
And you're like, oh, God.
That's good. That's called, you know.
Empathy right there.
Empathy. Yeah, and just like digging a hole, you know, continuing to dig. After you dug the hole for yourself. But on the other hand, you know, I find that the conservative outrage about this is, of course, overstated and overblown, and for blatantly political purposes. And it's, you know, it's like this genuinely irritating, perhaps mildly outrageous, something you would be outraged about for like 10 minutes and then you'd go like get a beer and you'd be fine. But it gets fed into the outrage machine and it becomes this huge, huge deal. And oh my God, we're into the world, NPR, let's defund NPR. This was a dumb move, but it doesn't represent.
Well, because they're saying that it's a freedom of speech issue and all this, and it's. I disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean it was a poor decision that reflects poorly on the organization that made it. If you look objectively at that organization's overall record, it's not like this is journalist. You know, this isn't some cabal.
Not only that, but I do think that when you read NPR's justification for firing Williams, it is within their rubric to fire him for his commentary
on paper. Yes, the question is whether they enforce that consistently, and I think the answer might be no.
The
Nina Totenberg thing has obviously been cited as an example.
The issue is that they were looking for a way to get rid of Williams for a while.
I think that's what happened. They exploited
this, and it was probably a poor decision.
I think that's exactly what happened. I think that they clearly just wanted to get rid of the guy, and it was such a ham-handed move to think they could do this and that'll be fine. And they were getting pressure from the certain people on the left to do it. But I just the whole thing is so blown out of proportion. And then you get into this sort of issue of defunding them. And the first thing that has to be understood about that is the actual facts, which, you know, God, who needs facts in this country? But NPR, national NPR, does not get any money directly from any government. They do get about 2% of their budget, I think, from competitive grants, which are funded by the government. But that's a little bit different than having the government hand you a check. If you're going to say you can't apply for grants, like you uniquely as an organization, other organizations can, but you can't apply for grants from the federal government, that would actually be discriminating against NPR. That wouldn't be saying like, oh, because they're...
It seems odd to cut funding to the local affiliates, right, who had no impact on the decision whatsoever.
And that's the other side of the equation, is the local affiliates get some of their, a small portion of their budget comes from direct government funding, either state, local, or federal. And then, of course, the affiliates pay programming fees to NPR. So then that always gets cited as, well, but this federal money is trickling down to the local stations. And then you also have things like, you know, and I was arguing with someone about this on Twitter, and he was sort of outlining the various ways in which the government gets money to NPR, and it went so far as, like, the university gives money to this. And I'm like, okay, so you know, you're a private university. Let's say you're USC, but you get a lot of money from the government if you're USC just because you're private. You get all these grants, you get all kinds of stuff. So you have government money coming into USC. So then USC decides that it's going to contribute money to a charity. And that charity gives money to a local NPR station. And that NPR station gives money to the national NPR.
Has anybody else completely lost right now? Brennan has just been talking and you've gone to rah, rah, rah.
My point is that this chain of federal funding, how far do you want to take that? To say that NPR uniquely as an entity in our economy can't get funding from like third or fourth hand federal monies. That's where you start getting into major percentages. But as long as you're just talking about direct federal funding or grant money that the national NPR gets from the federal government, you could cut that off and it wouldn't make much of a difference. My fear is that this hysteria about this issue is going to lead to a Jim DeMint or whoever having like a broader-based bill, which is really going to cripple the organization unfairly because like another network might be getting money that is more government-funded than NPR. You know, it's just because it's NPR, people have this impression.
I just don't think that it would pass. I mean, could you imagine,
Ken Buck could probably vote for it. Senator Buck, Senator...
Fuck Kennedy.
Kennedy fuck.
Yeah.
Ken Buck, Sharon Angle. I mean, who are you about to elect to the Senate? No, I mean, I think you're right. And it'll also die down in 5 minutes. You know, I mean, it'll keep getting a lot of play online. But that's one of the arguments I was having with somebody was, you know, somebody was trying to tell me this is going to affect the election. I think Andrew was trying to tell me it's going to, you know, 1 to 2% of the vote. And I'm like, are you kidding? Like maybe 0.1%. Like it could sway like a Florida type election, you know. But anything could sway that. You know, like the 2000 Florida election. You know, where it's like. You know, but I mean, this isn't going to cause the Republicans to win. Like, it's just people don't, the election is like a week and a half after this happened. It's going to be the people who are passionate about this, who are pissed off and fired up, are the Tea Partiers. They were already pissed off and, you know, they're going to go vote Republican anyway. But anyway, I
wonder how much the, in terms of election predictions, now that I'm going to get into this, cause I'm closing the door on one. I actually wonder if the Democrats are going to do better than we think they are, because the people who are screaming the loudest and getting the most attention are certainly the Tea Partiers. But there's, you know, a lot of interesting polling even about healthcare where, you know, 40% of people are like, repeal it, and that's all you hear. But 40% of people also wanted to go farther. You know, they want more regulation of the industry. They want more government involvement. And I think I want to hear about those people.
I think there's... Oh. Missouri's up by 8 now. Sweet. There's a lot of some of the polls that have been done that are less specific than that, and they just ask, you know, do you support or oppose the president's healthcare bill or the healthcare bill that was passed by the Congress? And you'll get, you know, 65% opposed, but when you drill down, 25% of them are opposed to it because they thought it didn't go far enough or whatever. You know, so yeah. I suspect that the Republicans will do really well in the elections, and we'll do next week. We'll do predictions, I think, but I think they'll do well. I think the pollsters are obviously taking all that into account. But one of the things they do is the likely voter screens to try to figure out who's likely to vote, and you know, the how does the enthusiasm gap come across? And the pollsters differ on that. Like Rasmussen, for example, thinks that the enthusiasm gap is wider, so they have more Republicans in their likely voter screen, whereas like some other organizations have less.
But
that's when you average it all out, you come to a probably a fairly reasonable projection, and that projection is the Republicans are going to gain like 50 seats in the House. If the enthusiasm gap is as big as like Fox News or whoever might be portraying it, it would be like a 70 to 80 seat gain. I don't think that'll happen. And then the Senate is just going to come down to a handful of races that are just close, like the Nevada race, which I like to refer to as Giant Douche versus the Turd Sandwich. Giant Douche is Harry Reid and Turd Sandwich is Sharon Angle, because everybody hates both of those candidates. It's hilarious. But anyway.
Brendan, has anybody ever told you you look Asian?
That was a Sharon Angle moment.
Anyways, I guess we should probably move on and think about what we're looking forward to.
No, you have to do the. You have to propose a topic that I won't care about.
I do?
Yeah.
Okay. Wait. Well, let me think about that for a second. I think I can do this. So, as some of you may or may not know, I work probably 3 out of 4 weekends selling products at grocery stores. And today I was selling a product line that has organic fruit supplements, and they're powdered. And now one of the things that sets aside these powdered fruit supplements is that they're not in a juice form. And I wanted to know your thoughts on powdered versus juice supplements.
That's not even really fair. Powdered versus juice supplements? Oh, hold on a second. Let me make this. I need juice to stop. Okay. I don't... The powdered ones can be kind of nasty at times if you don't...
Well, if they're encapsulated, they're actually quite nice.
Oh. I've never taken a powdered or a...
Yes, you have. A powdered supplement, that's just like a multivitamin. Oh. Or, you know, the vitamin C or echinacea that you take? That's a powdered supplement.
Okay. Well, I...
Oh, who won the challenge? So here, let me tell you some stuff about this powdered versus liquid supplement. So in particular, I had a powdered acai berry. And if you don't know about your acai berries, they are potent antioxidants, very good for your heart. And they also, like, cleanse your body. And a lot of times you're going to find acai in a juice form. Now, the benefit of taking it in a powdered form as opposed to a juice form is that the juice form is usually packed full of sugar. And you're also paying for water. You're paying for the overall parent company to ship you water. So it's better to buy, I think, in a powdered form because you're not paying to ship the water. Now, some people will argue that, you know, when you powder a fruit, you're taking out some sort of essential nutrient from the fruit that's magically present in the fruit when it's in its liquid form, but not in a powder form. But I think that's BS. So there you go. That is why you should like your powdered supplements.
Next week, I'm going to like pick some obscure legal topic and be like, so what do you think about res ipsa loquitur? You know, like.
Well, if you define what it is for me, I could probably spout some opinion on it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have no opinions about supplements.
Supplements. Well, see, there you go. Now you've learned something new. You know, you shouldn't pay to ship water. It's not green. You can get water from your tap. And you know, it's, you can get a more potent multivitamin with more stuff in it if you're not paying for the water. So think about that next time you're going to buy like your nasty green supplements that are in liquid form. Boo for liquid supplements. Boo. Same thing with your soaps, people. Like think about when you buy those like liquid soaps that you squish into your loofah, you're paying for water. Buy a bar soap. You have water in your shower already. Don't pay for water.
The phrase squish into your loofah sounds really, like, dirty.
I'll squish it into your loofah anytime, baby.
So, anyway, on that note.
Wow.
That
should be our tagline. Squishing into your loofah.
No, I don't think so. I think last week's we just barely could get away with, but this week's the Tom Taquito and the British Empire was just obscure enough to make people watch, but...
Oh, I think people would watch Into Your Loofah.
Yeah, but it's just a little weird. No,
don't comment on college football. It's dumb.
Your retroactive score update. Missouri's up by 8 with 9 minutes left, and I'm really excited. So they're probably going
to
lose.
So what are we looking forward to this week?
Yes.
You can go first.
No, you should go first, because mine is going to relate to the sign-off.
Oh, goodness, Brendan. Okay, what am I looking forward to this week? I'm not sure what I'm looking forward to this week. Why don't you go first, and then I can think of something.
You didn't give me that privilege last week when I was in the same boat. All right. Well, next, this is easy for me because, first of all, I should insert a scheduling note before we do this. Next week, we're going to be doing our podcast on Monday night rather than Sunday because Sunday night is Halloween. And it's also the launch night for both Kyle Wellaston's Season 7 Mid-Majority blog and my Denver Pioneers blog. And so I'm going to be busy with that once Halloween's over. And so we're going to do a special Election Eve podcast on Monday night.
And we're also taking suggestions for reject names for Brendan's Denver blog.
Yes, it's
his DU blog. So if you have, you know, horrible names for the Pioneer Post that you would like to come up with, I would love to hear them.
Yes, good names are also encouraged, but bad names, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. So anyway, that's going on. And so as a result, we won't be speaking to you again until Monday. So with that in mind, what I'm really looking forward to is pretty much all of next weekend because it's a big weekend. Saturday is my birthday, which, I mean, frankly, it'll probably mostly involve running around to little kids' birthday parties that happen to be happening that weekend as well. And my only request to Becky for my birthday was that she put the girls to bed on that evening so that I can watch the Oregon game. Because I have this terrible problem with these primetime games. They always start at 6, and the girls go to bed at like 7:15. So between 6 and 7, we're always scrambling around, maybe giving them a bath or whatever, getting dinner. And so I can't really watch the game. And then I go upstairs and put them to bed. By the time I come downstairs, it's halftime. So I missed the entire first half of these primetime games. I'd actually like to watch the first half of USC Oregon, especially because by halftime, Oregon will probably be up by like 3 touchdowns. But I didn't just say that. Wait, did Missouri just get the ball back? Yes! Woo! Anyway. So what I'm looking forward to next week is my birthday and then the USC-Oregon game in which USC will be playing perhaps now the number one team in the BCS, maybe, if Missouri holds on, as well as the number one team in the AP at home. It's going to be a red out. USC Psycho has been organizing getting everybody to wear red to the Coliseum or a Cardinal, you know, out. And then, of course, the next day, and we're going to win because there's always hope. And then the next day is going to be Halloween. And of course, our girls will be wearing adorable Halloween costumes. Loyette is going to be a Winnie the Pooh themed pumpkin. It says Pooh on the front. And
she's Winnie the Pooh as a pumpkin.
She's Winnie the Pooh as a pumpkin.
It's a costume within a costume.
This is like the inception of costumes. And then Loyacita is going to be a honeypot. So we're going to have a
pumpkin. Isn't that cute?
So we're going to have a pumpkin and a honeypot.
No, we're going to have Winnie the Pooh and a honeypot. You have no imagination here, Brendan.
So anyway, that'll be a lot of fun. The whole Halloween trick-or-treating with little kids being cute.
Oh, by the way, we have 600 pieces of candy to give out. And I would like you all to guess how long that will last. And we will let you know on our next podcast.
Yeah. Can we give some background on why we're asking that question?
No. Just let people guess.
That was part of my answer, what I'm looking forward to. We live in a neighborhood that is very, very friendly to having tons of trick-or-treaters because, first of all, there are a gajillion little kids in the neighborhood. And then on top of that, because we're like the well-off area in our overall, like larger part of Denver, a lot of people from south of our neighborhood who are less well-off and perhaps wouldn't get as much candy in their neighborhoods all come up. It may not be safe to go trick-or-treating. Yeah. They all come up to our
and
area.
They're so cute. Yeah. I mean,
you get all these cute little Hispanic kids and black kids and stuff. Yeah.
Adorable costumes. They're so cute.
And so it's just like, I mean, it's just constant. There's just a constant stream of trick-or-treaters. It just never ends. It's kind of crazy. It's been a lot of fun. So that's what I'm looking forward to. What are you looking forward to?
You know, you could just say, like, I'm looking forward to pumpkin pie.
No, I have an elaborate, it's my birthday. It's a big weekend for me.
What am I looking
forward to? I'm turning 29, people. It's my last year in my 20s. After this year, it's all downhill.
Yeah, does anybody have a bucket list for Brendan? Things he should do while he's, you know, before he hits the big 3-0?
Are you suggesting that I'm going to die when I turn 30?
Well, doesn't life end at 30, Brendan? Come on. Your youth is gone. What am I looking forward to now that I've just offended like 99% of our...
Woo!
Oh, my God.
Missouri's up by 2 touchdowns.
What? Okay.
Now that you've offended half the audience, yes.
Yes. I can't have to focus. You've distracted me. I'm flustered now. Well, I have to make Loyacita's costume still, because I'm making her honeypot costume. So I suppose I'm looking forward to that in the way that anybody really looks forward to a chore they don't really want to do. And I guess I'm looking forward to Brennan's birthday. I'm planning a big surprise, and I'm hoping that he won't cotton on to what it is.
Planning a big surprise, eh?
No.
You do realize that I'm sitting here, right?
No idea what he's talking about, people.
So anyway, as a sign off, okay, there's a cat on me. as a sign off, I have a message about USC's upcoming game with number one ranked Oregon, which played UCLA on Thursday and looked completely unstoppable. Looks completely unstoppable. But oh wait, we need volume. All right, hold on. All right. Anyway, so here's my thought on USC.
Give me Oregon. A soul.
This is going to go on longer than it needs to, but I didn't pre-select the clip, so we're going to have to get to the blah, blah, blah. Or
this is a nice sword, young man. Let me see your sword. You have a tumor on your forehead. That is unfortunate. Are you Haitian? Do you have cholera?
Wait, okay, hold on. You talked over the important part.
They say that it is hopeless.
Say that it is hopeless. We can't beat Oregon, Becky. It's hopeless.
Not with my giant sword, young one. I can beat anyone.
This is a good sword. Halith, son of Hama. There is always hope.
Now, unfortunately, I don't know that USC is going to be bailed out by a wizard arriving over a giant hill with a huge army and then a bunch of talking trees coming in.
Well, there's a bunch of horses,
but,
isn't it?
But
isn't this the battle with the horses?
Yeah.
Like Traveler?
That's true. That's a good point.
Right,
Traveler.
Right,
I don't know how we can work in the talking trees because that would be Stanford, but, you know, we'll figure it out.
Well, Stanford will be whispering about how good we are.
So anyway, on that note...
Whispers of a nameless fear, the USC offense kicking your ass.
So we're gonna leave you with a little bit of a wish for the game. And we'll see you... Oh, one other programming note before we do that. On Monday, in addition to election predictions, we will hopefully have the world premiere of my, or our, if you contribute to it, song, pre-election song for Obama, Obama singing I Dreamed a Dream.
Oh, did you know that UCLA's quarterback was just out for the season with a season-ending knee injury?
Does that have anything to do with anything?
apparently Obama's going to hurt his knee in your song.
I don't think I knew that, no.
See? There you go.
Yeah. But anyway, Obama singing I Dreamed a Dream and how everything's falling apart, and it'll be fun. So, anyway.
Did they take away?
Okay, we have to say goodbye.
Yeah. So, good night. Goodbye, everybody. We will see you on Monday, and fight on.
Beat the Ducks!
What the fuck? This is not the Michael Bennett theme song.
Dude, do you want Ken Buck to represent you? Because I don't want him representing me.
Well, no, but that's next week's podcast. Maybe we can do elections next week.
Quack, quack.
If you can't see this, but of course we were doing a fight on thing. Vacation. I wish we had Lloyd here to go doo-doo.
Yeah, she would like that.
Although I don't wish that we had a representation to do like that.
I should count the number of times you interrupt yourself during this podcast. So you're like, Brendan's ADD moments? 15! God, our band rocks.